Good evening. My name's Norman. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. What are you trying to imply? I'd like to thank the committee and Mary so much for everything. It really is an honor and a privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's especially more special because I've got my mama here. You know, and I'm so used to being the one sitting down there watching. This is different this time. I want to welcome all the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to let you know it works. It works good, and it works slow. Everything I'm going to say here tonight, my opinion alone. I don't know if this is the way my life went down, but it's the way I see it. You can tell I'm a Mexican, right? And I'm of the Mexican variety that my family had parties every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I believe I was born an alcoholic, and I also believe I was born a liar and a cheat and a manipulator. That stuff comes natural to me. Bill W. wrote, the common becomes the uncommon, and the most common thing for me to do is to be a liar, a cheat, and a manipulator. And when I was a kid, they used to think it was cute to give us all a glass of beer. And I used to go from relative to relative to get me some of that beer. And in the olden days, they didn't buy six-packs or cases of beer. They bought cakes of beer. With the big blocks of ice and those chunks of salt. And they used to keep it in the bathroom, you know. And I'd go in there, I'd try to put me some of that beer and get none of the foam. But, you know, when I was a little girl, I lived behind my grandmother's house, and I adored my grandmother. And when I was a kid, I remember the first feeling I ever felt was I always felt rejected and unloved and unwanted. You see, I used to sleep in a little walk-in closet, and my older sister got to sleep with my mama. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night crying and yearning for my mother. And there used to be a little window in that walk-in closet, and I remember looking out that window and wondering why I couldn't sleep with my mother. Well, the truth of the matter is I went to bed. That's why I didn't get to sleep with my mother. But you know, when you're 4 years old, you don't know that's the reason. You just feel unloved and unwanted, rejected. I was always very envious of my sister. Because I always thought that my sister had a better bond with my mother. I just hung out with my grandma. And when I was little, I was a battered kid. And see what kind of kid I was. When my grandmother always, we used to live behind my grandmother's house, and she always had See's candy in the refrigerator. And they never let us have See's candy because it's bad for your teeth and your hair. And when nobody was around, I'd sneak in and eat chocolate. Slam it in my face, right? Real quickly before they show up. And my mother would come and she'd say, Norma, did you eat that chocolate? And I'd say, no. She'd start hitting me. No, no, no. She'd grab me by the arm, take me to the mirror, and there'd be chocolate all over my face. And I don't know how it got there, okay? I would lie under any and all conditions. I didn't care if they caught the goods on me. I didn't do it. That's the kind of kid I was. When I was 8 years old, we moved to Mira Loma, and that's when I had my first blackout drunk. And I remember we had a family baptism, and I remember it was Friday, and then I came to it was about 1 or 2 in the afternoon on Sunday morning. I remember walking around that house, and I could hear them inside whispering about who had given me so much. I didn't know what I did, but I felt ashamed. I knew it was bad. And that was the first time I ever felt remorse. And I'm also a recovering Catholic. I don't know if there's any Catholics here. I went to Catholic school for a little hot second. But you know, you go into and tell the priest your sins. You know, I told him I might have lied once or twice or maybe stole half a time or so. I never told the truth. And when you go in, you take this, tell the priest your sins, and then you, in the morning, in the olden days, you were supposed to not eat before you took the host. I always ate. Just to see what God going to do. I was always testing what he was going to do. And I remember when I was a little girl, I used to yearn for my daddy to come home, you see, because when my daddy was around, my mother wasn't so violent. And I used to go out to where the horses were, and I used to hit my knees. I used to pray to God to bring, please bring me my daddy. And I used to yearn for my mother, you see, because not only was my mother violent, but she was also very loving. So I used to think that someplace she was gagged someplace, you know, and she was taped up. So I used to look for her in the barns and in the cupboards. And so when God didn't bring me my mama and he didn't let me find my daddy, I gave him the finger. I said, I'm never praying to you again. And, you know, when I was a kid, my mother used to always say that my daddy was sick. They used to say he was in college. He was a heroin addict. He was always in the joint a lot. And but you see, my mother always cleaned it up for him. She never said anything to clean it up for herself, you see. So I always thought that there was something. I was always terrified of my mother. I was always sneaky. I was always, you know, a people pleaser in front of her and doing my number behind her. And when I was about 10 years old, she moved us to Pomona. My mother decided to get sober. So she moved us to Pomona, where before we had lived in a predominantly off-white area with, you know, farmers and dairy people. She moved us to Pomona where the girls ratted their hair up, huh? And they wore tight skirts and they used to wait for us after the school every day to give us our initiation. And I cried to the teacher, they're going to beat me up. I told you I was a thief, right? Well, my mother decides to go on a diet when she gets sober, right? I'm also a Mexican reject. I wasn't raised on beans and rice and tortillas. I was raised on pot pies, TV dinners, and bologna sandwiches. And you know, that's still, I still like that food, you know? She made beans one time and she added spinach to it, okay? Anyway, she moved us to Pomona, and the girls used to wait for us every day after school, and on the last day of school, they ganged up, and they beat my sister up, the guys and the girls. And the next semester, my sister got to go to another school, and one more time, you know, I wasn't good enough. One more time, I had to suck it in and stay there. And those girls that used to wrap their hair up, and they used to wait for me every day after school to beat me up. You know, I'd cry to the teacher and tell her they're going to hurt me. And since my mom was on this diet, you know, I used to do these little burglaries to at other people's houses. You know, I never thought about stealing their money or their stuff. I went over there to eat sandwiches and potato chips and cookies. And in the olden days, they used to have those double desks. I know you, some of you remember those double desks. And the girl I shared my desk with was a white girl. We had a little dispute. I wasn't intimidated by white. And I called her a monkey, and she took it personal. And so when I went on this eating excursion, she was coming down the playground. And she's coming with her little friends to confront me. And her mouth started to move like my mother's. And it started perspiring up here. I knew what that meant. Next thing I knew, I hit her. I broke her arm. I blacked out. And all those cholas said, don't cry, Norma. Wait till you get to the bathroom. You see, finally, somebody was going to pay for the things that were going on at my house, you see. Not only was I being battered by my mother mentally and physically, but also by my sister. And that day, I learned to be a victimizer. So I started writing my hair up. I started taking in my mother's skirts and wearing those little tiny diamond nylons. And when right as I'm doing this, I'm watching Hobo Kelly, right? Huh? Because I'm only a little girl. And that's when my life actually took a split. That's when I know that I started to live a double life. My mother was a good AA-er. She went to meetings every day. From 7:30 to 10 o'clock, my mother was gone. From 7:30 to 9:30, we had the boys over. We're doing a little spray paint, a little glue. There was no alcohol. You know, my drug of choice is whatever you got. We do one, right? You can tell I have curly hair, right? Well, I was raised in the Sonny and Cher era. You know, I try to be a surfer. You can kind of see how that one stayed with me. But I used to iron my hair. And in those days, they didn't have curling irons or things that make your hair straight. So I used to iron it with iron. And then whack it and go to school with these three little holes right here. And I swear to God that I think my hair is receding here because of all those whacks. So what happened is that my mother moved us to the other side of Pomona. You know, the book talks about seeking lower companions. I took 3 buses to get to the barrio. I was the best-dressed chola at the barrio. All the girls wanted to be my friend because I had money, huh? Because I was a buyer. I'll treat. And not only that, but I'd fight your battles for you. I had a lot of suppressed anger, you know, and she moved us to Pomona, and then she moved us to Montclair, and I was in drill team. And I hung out with a little bit of everybody. The bikers, the cheerleaders, you know, the soldiers, the cholas. And all the girls were talking about this guy. You know, he had a nice car, and he was out of school, and he was 6'3", and he was blonde, and he had soul. And all the girls wanted him. You know I had to have him. So this guy introduces me to Boone's Farm Apple Wine and Red. So I marry this guy. I'm 16 years old. I'm getting loaded. And I would get a little violent with the Red. And one time he went to the liquor store and he came in at the same time as this chick and I knew he was with her. I don't know if he was, but my head said he was. So I picked up a beer bottle and broke it on his face just in case, huh? And that wasn't even the last of it. The last of it is that he decided he was going to give me a divorce, so I picked up a bottle and I broke it over his head and I went to juvenile hall and I swore when I got out of juvenile that I was going to kill him. You know, so I'm starting to hitchhike. Kill this guy. His family sent him to Ontario, Canada. I've never been out of Montclair, so I started hitchhiking to go to Ontario, Canada to kill this guy. But something happened on the way to Ontario, Canada. I started drinking. I started having fun. I forgot what my primary purpose was. And something happened in my home that drew me to come back home. And when I came back home, I got rid of that Boone's Farm apple wine, those reds. That stuff made me too violent. So I decided to get myself a job and get myself a nice, cute 64 Chevy with a big steering wheel, right? But I get a 6-inch because I can't see over it, right? And I get rid of that wine and those reds, and I switch to a little 151 Bacardi and RC Cola. Some of you might remember RC Cola with Bacardi, right? And I used to wrap my hair real high back in the Cascade days when you put those hair pieces in. Big, huh? And wear those double eyelashes, you know, those on the top and the bottom. By then, we moved to Orange County. And I'm claiming Ontario, which is about 45 minutes from Orange County, and that's where I'm from. I'm from Ontario. And every Friday night, we beat up the girls from out of town. And the next day, we pick up our hair where they pulled it out, right? Our hair pieces. And on Monday morning, about 2, 3 o'clock in the morning when I was coming back, because you know you got to go to work, drop a few more little whites, you know, or a couple of black beauties so you can hear the alarm, right? So I put the alarm, and I'm hurrying up trying to go to sleep, and the room's spinning. So you want to hurry up and go to sleep before they kick in, right? Then the alarm rings. You haven't even had a wink of sleep yet, and you wake up with the shakes. You know you've got the shakes. So you get up, and you go to the bathroom, and you, like, give yourself a quickie little toothbrush, you know? And you know you should take a shower, but you don't, you know? And throw a little extra perfume to hide the smell of the drink, right? Drop a few little winter green lifesavers to kill the taste, right? And go to work. By that time, I must be about 17 or 18. And, you know, when I get to work, I swear that I'm not going to drink today. I go and have a kawama, which is an 80-ouncer for lunch, right? I don't know about you, but I would go out there with a guy drinking 80-ouncers to fix myself, you know. And then I'd go back to work, and I'd have that conversation in my mind that tonight is going to be different. Tonight I'm going to go home and get me some rest as I'm nodding out at work, right? And if something will happen when I finish that thought, I go, I wonder what the girls are doing tonight. And what happened is, you know how you keep doing the same thing over and over? Well, the problem was Ontario. That's the problem. I get too much trouble over there. So I start hanging out in East LA, right? Huh? And, you know, I used to buy these big gallons. I've heard speakers say that they were went to different liquor stores because they were embarrassed how much they drank. I took pride in how much I could drink. I used to buy that gallon of 151 Bacardi and tell the liquor store guy, I'm saving for change, you know? And I would line the window of my house, of my room with these big old bottles. And my mother never thought I had a drinking problem. I guess that's a good delusion, huh? And, I used to line my window with all these 151 Bacardi, then when she'd bring her babies over, and this sweet little lady named Ira Tammy, she asked me one time if I had a problem with drinking. And I said, heck no, I don't have a problem. I'm having fun. And so, you know, I used to do a lot of drinking and a lot of partying, and one day I hadn't had anything to drink, and my cousin lived next door, and he was going over to his in-law's house. And I don't know if you'd be an alcoholic like me, but that day I only had a shot of whiskey. And for me, that is just an opener. And when I had that shot of whiskey, the next day his wife, who did not drink, was sure to tell me that I had been all over a cousin of mine, that I had been sitting on his lap, stroking his hair, and I cringed at the idea. You see, because I couldn't stand him. When I was a little girl, he was always trying to pump on me. He was always trying to molest me. And when she told me that, I couldn't stand it. You know, and I remembered some of the things that they had said. And, you know, I've been to hundreds and hundreds of AA meetings. I remember when I gave that lady her first year cake, and she got up to the podium, and she was talking about how things were so wonderful. And I said, I looked over at my sister, and I said, well, the real Angie, please stand up. I went to hundreds of AA meetings, and AA meetings never kept me sober. I learned a lot of exciting things to try, and it earned me my seat. So anyway, when that woman told me that about what I had done, you know, I thought, you know, that for me, the difference between a social drinker and an alcoholic is a social drinker is having a good time and drinks to have a better time. And an alcoholic of my variety drinks for the good time. You see, I was always drinking when I'm vulnerable in my clothes. You know, I'm always drinking when I'm putting that war paint on. I'm always drinking when I'm in the shower. I drink and drive. I mean, not everybody. You know, and I used to keep it in the trunk of my car, the 151 Bacardi. And when this woman told me I had done that, I thought maybe, you know, I better cool it a little bit. So I start jogging 7-10 miles a day, you know. And, you know, we didn't read it in chapter 3, but they were talking about me. But I would jog 7-10 miles a day. I quit drinking. I decided to go to college. That's what I needed. I broadened my horizon. I started dabbling in that other book that, you know, that gives me curly hair. That book. Anyway, I started dabbling in that, and I smoke a little weed. you know, weed ain't bad. And I remember my sister called me up and she told me she was going to AA. And I said, oh God, Lorraine, you just want to be like Mom. So I sent her a lid of weed and she broke her sobriety. Obviously she wasn't done. I helped her to remove all doubt. So you know, when I'm going to, you know, I'm smoking this weed, I'm on weed maintenance, you know, and I'm living in a reborn Christian complex, all furnished apartment, you know, and I'm going to school and I'm doing good, and I take this class called political science. And I smoke me a joint before the final, get me the same sense over and over. Get an F. Next semester, I see him in the same seat, the same instructor, the same final, same behavior, same sentence, same F. Common sense to anybody would say that we'd the problem, right? I said to myself, I know what the problem is. I'm deaf. That's what the problem is. My mom always said I was stupid, and I could be sure. And I never thought it was, I never discovered it was the weed until I got sober. And what happened for me is my girlfriend, she brought these two guys over. I hadn't had a drink for 3 years, right? It's been a little weak. And she brought these guys over, and I had a shadow. And then it was two pints. And she asked one of the guys where he lived, and he said someplace by the Orange Circle. My mother lived by the Orange Circle. There was a bat fighting. I picked up the bat, beat the shit out of my girlfriend, destroyed the apartment. The guys left. The cops came and bit her little nipple. I got in a physical confrontation with the cops, and he said, you know what, out of me. I ran out of the apartment, knocked on the landlady's door, and said, pray for me as they're taking me to jail. And it had been 3 years since I had a drink. And I really, really knew, deep down inside of me, I knew maybe there was a problem. So I switched to a little social heroin. I never wanted to be like my mother. I'd rather be more like my father. So I switched to a little social heroin, and everything I swore I wouldn't do, I started doing. See, I started running my, I lived in one of my grandmother's three-bedroom houses, and she lived a little distance away, and I started renting that house to legal idiots. I figured, you know, if they tell on me, I'll call immigration, right? Well, they all got together, and they told on me. And by that time, I had burnt all of my bridges. There was absolutely nobody and no one I could have called. And when I went to jail, and I got out of jail from that, episode, I had absolutely nowhere and no place to go. I put all of my belongings in a shopping cart. And that started my life in a comprehensible moral life, the way that we talked about. So that's a big word for me. I've never fallen into an house enough. You know, and but I know what it is to live up. You see, I put all my things in the cart and I thought I was free. All my life, I just wanted to show what Christ had given me. I was so angry at God. I told you I gave him the finger. I was never one of those persons that went to jail and said, God, get me out of this one. I would hear the girls in jail talk about, you know, God did, and I'd say, what are you talking about? God didn't get you here. Don't even mention that word to me. I was so full of rage at God. And I remember walking those those guys and those bicycles and seemed so furious. I thought the only thing good about a Christian is when the cops come. You know, when the cops come, you go over there and you make a, you know, talk to them so they don't stop you. You know, that's the only reason I went to talk to a Christian. But anyway, what happened is that I had all my things in the car and I started, you know, I never sold my body when I was in prison. And the only reason I didn't sell it is I didn't think anything would buy it. You know, I suffered from a lot of low self-worth and low self-esteem, and I was in a bitter rage. You see, I was 28 and I got sober when I was 34. And when I was out on that street, everything inevitably stopped working for me. So I incorporated a little cocaine into that little social heroin. And I started puffing out my eyebrows and all my eyelashes, and I had a big bald spot in the back of my hair. And I weighed 76 pounds. I had sores all over my face, and I'm looking good, okay? Huh? I didn't think there was a problem here. You know, maybe I was a little strung out, but there was nothing, you know, to write home about every now and then. You know, I'd go to jail, straighten up for a minute, and come on, do it some more. And I remember sometimes my great enabler, she would go to jail, and I'd have to pass her my time. And I remember staying up all night for days and days. And I remember I would yearn for a little oatmeal and warm toast. So I would be the first one at the Salvation Army to eat some warm toast. And I would wait there at like 3 o'clock in the morning all the way till 8 o'clock when they would be serving. And I'd be the first one there. And when they start serving, I'd get me some cold toast. And I'd start hollering and screaming that don't they know I've been there all night. And they'd 86 me from the Salvation Army each night. There was so much change when I lived on the street. I would see everybody going to work and I would wonder what happened to me. How did I get so far away? See, everybody was going to work. You know, it's a rainy day today. And this morning I've seen a homeless guy. And I know what he feels. I know what it is to be homeless and want to use the restroom, be a woman and need to use the restroom, and they won't let you at the gas station. I know what it is to go inside a fast food place and they won't let you in. You see, those are the things that my alcoholism took me through. There was so much agony. I just wanted to die so badly, and my body wouldn't die. You know, and I would go to jail, and I'd call my mother, and I told her I wanted to get sober. And she said, "For God's sake, Norma, I'm making dinner for John Harris. If you want to get sober," she said, "someplace in Indio." I never heard of Indio. She said, "someplace by Betty Ford." I went around that jail telling everybody, "I'm going to Betty Ford. Mama said she's sending me to the best recovery home she knew. I'm going to be sunning and mudding with Elizabeth Taylor, huh?" I told you what I look like. My God, I would have never fit there. I would have never fit in there. I was the kind of alcoholic you see on the corner, you step away because there's oxygen in town. I always thought I saw bugs grunting up and down my skins and coming out of the holes in my face. And people just stepped away from me. And when I called my mother and I asked her about this recovery home, and she said, you know, if I wanted to get sober, I needed to write them a letter. So I wrote him a letter, and the day when I got out of jail, you know, you meet your friends in the Sally Port. You know, they start talking about going to other places. So I start leaving the jail, right? Well, we'll just go innocent 7-Eleven, right, cookies? And so anyway, what happened for me is when I was walking out of that jail, I felt, that great cloud. I felt that impending doom that I used to have as I walked around on the street. And I ran back to the jail, and they called the lady that was supposed to pick me up. And I remember she picked me up, and in Riverside, my mother picked me up, and she starts taking me to Indio, and she says those things some of you mothers say to their kids who have the same problem as all of us. She said, "This is the last time you ever have to do this. Give yourself a break." You know, and I remember when we were traveling to Indio, I don't know if anybody's been out to Indio. I'm from Orange County in L.A. There's nothing but sand and tumbleweed. And when we're getting off to go to this place, I think we're getting off for coffee, right? It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. And we roll in front of this building. It's big and it's dark, and so there's nobody there. So we roll around down the alley. There's a shooting gallery across the way. There's these four cats. Everybody knows what cats means. It means mice. And I was so arrogant. I said, "Shoot, I ain't staying here. I got loaded in better places than this." You know, and people, you know, and bigger than hooting, and here comes this old lady down the stairs. And she tells me to get on the couch, to sleep on the couch, and don't use the phone. You know, all night I'm thinking, who can I call? Somebody help me! When that sweet old lady who's passed on this last year, when she took me in to do my intake, she asked that question you're not supposed to ask area people. She asked me what my drug of choice was. And I said, heroin. And she said, did you ever use alcohol? And I said, yes. And she said, can you see how your alcoholism led you to try other things? And I said, yes. And I believe that that was my first moment of clarity. She said, therefore, we identify ourselves as an alcoholic. We no longer want to be different. The person that might save your life that day might just be an alcoholic and not relate to anything else. She said, you get a sponsor and you work the steps. I got a sponsor who had 27 years of sobriety. I want someone who knew to stop. My mother had 23 and a half years sober. My sister had 8 years sober, and I didn't want a day they had. So I got this sponsor. I started working the steps. I had 7 affairs my first year and a half of sobriety. It's been a long time since anybody noticed me. And what I got from that is that God uses my defects of character to keep me where he wants me to be. And the reason I say that is because when I was a newcomer and I would be sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you look two together. You know what I mean? I told you what I looked like. I didn't feel like I belonged here. And as soon as we said that prayer, I let go and I ran. You know, and so I know that they kept, that was the attraction. You know, it was the attraction. It wasn't the promotion. You see, because I had a lot of resentment with AA. AA knew all my stuff all my life. I never liked AA. I always expected Alcoholics Anonymous to cure my mama. And it didn't. I was so rageful that I was an Alcoholics Anonymous. So, with that I know that God was working in my life. And I started working my steps. And I told you I was a God-hater. And in the desert, it's windy. And I chose the wind as my God. And every time it touched my face, or I heard it move the tree, I acknowledged that that was God. And that's how my journey began with my higher power. And in the morning, I'd say, please keep me sober. And the nighttime, I'd say, thank you. And when I was about 8 months sober, I got a little job. And what happened for me is, it was on my 8-month birthday, November 27th of 1989. My boss took me up to the attic, and I was howling and screaming because we were taking those artificial Christmas trees down. And I said, why? I'm the only woman here, and why don't you take one of the guys up there? So we're moving these Christmas trees, and as I get deeper into the attic, I step and I fall through the ceiling. And I'm falling through the ceiling and I hit some shelf and I sprung back up and I hit again and I landed on my feet both times. And that day, I learned that God was in charge of my life. You see, because I didn't break anything except for a few teeth, but they were probably on the rot anyway, you know? That day I realized that God was really in charge of my life because left to me, I would have saved myself. I would have grabbed something. I would have helped me, you know. But, you know, that day I really knew that God was in charge of my life, that he had something for me. And, when I was 14 months sober, my grandmother that I adored died, or 14, 16, that neighborhood. You know, I can't remember too well, but my grandmother died and I got mad at God. I said, take my mama, take my sister, 2-for-1, but give me my grandma back. You see that sponsor that I had that had all that time? She did an inventory like the old timers do in the biography form. And I still did a lot of pointing. I still did a lot of blaming. And when I got done with that inventory, what I got out of that inventory is I knew that something greater than me got me there. And in the morning after I had done that inventory and that fifth step, I got on the scale because, you see, I came in here at 76 pounds, but by my fourth month, I was weighing 156. Huh? I guess my body thought he better get a reserve because I'm going to starve again, huh? So my body was hanging on to everything that I ate. Plus stuffing feelings, right? So when my grandmother died, I got mad at God. You know, because see, I got to make my amends to my grandmother. And I adored my grandmother. And you see, when God takes something away, he replaces it with something else. It's called the pen and the paper. You know, I had to pick up the pen and the paper and do some more inventories to let my mother and my sister off the hook. You see, because I recognize that they did the best they can. That's what I got. They did the best they could. And I was 34 years old, still pulling on my blankie everything that ever happened to me. So what happened is I failed to tell you that I was in a relationship for 12 years while I was having those 7 affairs. I decided to move back and try to mend that relationship. I'm here to tell you, you don't get all your relationships back just because you get sober. So I moved back over here to Los Angeles. Well, I moved back to Los Angeles. And I was very resentful at LA's AA meetings because it was an Indios meeting. And they kind of did like, you know, we used to do at that recovery house, like they were reading the steps and the traditions, you know, chanting, you know, and... So I moved to L.A. and I relearned how to do a number of things. And when I came back to L.A., I tried to mend that relationship and I couldn't. And I got a job. And I told them who I was and they gave me a job. And I had that job for 5.5 years. And I tried to mend that relationship and I couldn't. And what happened is I made a conscious decision one day when I was doing the laundry that I had had enough. And about 3 months later, they sold the company that I worked, and they told me that they were going to keep me. And they didn't keep me, and that they were going to turn it over. An hour before, they gave me my seventh pay. And I was so hurt that they had lied to me. And I was already grieving that relationship. So I packed all my things, and I went home, and I was crying, and I went home, and I got on my knees. And I thank God for allowing me to experience the pain. And then I remembered what Mother Teresa said. She said, God don't give you more than you can handle, but she wished she didn't have so much confidence in her. I knew what she meant that day. You see, because I just felt like everything that was so familiar was out of my reach. Like everything in my life was not... I didn't know which way to go or which way to turn. So I just started working more and being of service. I started to go to more meetings. I started to do the things that we do here. And I said, I know what I want to be. I want to be a car salesman. That's what I want. I sold 14 cars my first month. I didn't make any money, but I sold 14 cars. And you know what? I made a whole bunch of people a good deal. You know, but I can't do that work anymore. You know, I started making, fixing my TRW. I don't know, I didn't even know I went to the hospital that many times. I had so many hospital bills on my TRW. You know, so I started paying them one at a time. And when my grandmother died, she left me a little money. So I remembered I owed this girl some money. This girl that I owed some money to. And so I'm going all cheerful, grateful that I'm going to go pay this money. And I go knock on the door. And they're not home. So I go over to her sister's house and I wait for them to come back. And they find out I'm there. And they start fighting. What is she doing in your house? So then, you know, I know they're home. I go in and knock on the door again. And she says, get out of here. You don't get out of here. We're going to call the cops. And I start shaking. You know why? Because I remembered I picked up a few felony beefs in her name. You know how you kind of burn your name when you're on the street and the cops come and you got to think of somebody else? She's who I thought of. You know, and so I went, you know, I did what the book says. It says you pause and you ask God for strength, and I knocked on the door again. And I said that I was sorry for any pain I had caused her, that she had been nothing but kind and loving to me, and that I wasn't there to change anything except to right the wrong I had done. And they opened the door. And I went in there and I told them what I was doing there, that I was there to right the wrong I had done. And I explained to it like the book says. And they didn't take my check. You know, they listened, but they didn't take my check. And they said, good, good, good. So then I went home and, you know, I got to keep the money. So then about 2 weeks later, they called me up and asked for the money. Huh? I had to call my sponsor. I was like, I was resentful. Well, I mean, they didn't want it. She said, Norma, give them their money. You're only holding it for them. You know how sponsors be doing things. You know, and then what happened is that, you know, like I said, I wasn't selling cars, and so I was living on this money that I was getting a little unemployment, and I had this little money in the bank, and so I was real concerned. I love staying at home. I love it. And then you get things like stuff from your sponsors that says, we are self-supporting through our own contributions. I go, I'm self-supporting my unemployment, my money in the bank. She goes, no, Norma, you got to get a job. So I start looking in the paper, and I start sending these resumes to all the ones you don't want, right? And then this guy calls me on the phone, and he tells me, you know, come in. And I said, okay. So I go in, I talk to him, and he tells me how much money it is. And I said, oh, no, that's not enough. I need $400 more. He says, okay. And then he goes, well, when can you start? I go, I need 2 weeks vacation. Huh? And it has turned out to be the best job that I ever had. You see, I don't know what's best for me. You know, left to my devices, I send it to all the places I don't want to work and get it. Huh? And then it's a good job. Huh? You know, I wanted to share something with you. You know, I have so many different defects of character that there's a section in the book Reflections. This is my opinion. In the book Reflection on October 20th, it talks about the way that God looks at my defects of character. This is the way I have interpreted what it says. And you know, when you have a little tiny baby puppy and it's so little and you squeeze it and it grunts and smells like bologna, huh? Huh? And in the nighttime when you're going to go to sleep, you make him a little space to sleep. And in the morning you get up and he's made little baby poo-poo and stick his foot in it, huh? And you get the puppy and you just wash the little puppy. I believe that's how God looks at my defects of character. He just cleans up the poo-poo and sends me on my way. You see, because I have to have a lot of pain before I make any changes in my life. You know, if I would have known that I was going to get sober, I would have had me one more. Just in case. If I would have known. You know, and I have more than I need. I have more than I deserve. I never did a good deed to deserve sobriety. I never did a nice thing to get what I have today. I have more than I need. More than I need. I have a great relationship with my mother. I have a great relationship with my sponsor. And I have a nice relationship with myself. I accept me just a little bit more than I did last year. You know, and at the beginning, I just had a baby symbol of faith. And it seemed like everything was wonderful. And I said, I remember when I was new, I said, if it doesn't get any better than this, I'll be happy. And it seems that it gets bigger and bigger in my tougherness over from so much gratitude. You see, because I've gotten to live two lifestyles in one lifetime. You see? And it's all from Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I never wanted from AA, you know, I never knew how wonderful it could be. I never knew what a beautiful life I could have, you know, and the relationship that I have with God. You know, I never thought I was insane. You know, it didn't matter if I ate out of trash cans, talked to myself. I just never thought I was crazy. You know, and God has, despite all that, has made me sober. For that, I'm grateful. Thank you.